Boy.
Why would you do it, you? Know all the things we know. Won't you stand up for truth? Why would you turn away to?
Get your dose of truth with the Truth Hurts Radio Show with your host, Charles Giuliani, Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern. The truth hurts. Ignorance kills.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
We all have one. Our entire view of the world is based on it. Welcome to the Unabridged Universe. We invite you to set your perspective aside for a moment and join us on a refreshing journey into aspects of your universe that you may not have noticed from your particular point of view. Let host Jason Wilson be your guide into the corners of the universe you've never peeked into before. Who knows? You may just enjoy it and end up coming back for more. Take a stroll into the Unabridged Universe, live Saturdays from 7 to 9 Central Standard Time, only on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Do you like to ask questions about everything? Would you like to escape from your proverbial box? Just leap out and explore our world in ways you've never imagined? You can have that opportunity. As we grow and expand, new features will be added, allowing you to experience radio programming at a fresh new level. I invite you to join me, November Hansen, host of Voice of the People. Together, we can expand our horizons and peer into multifaceted possibilities. This program will broadcast live Saturday evenings on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, this is James Arthur Janczyk, the Black Knight of Talk Radio, inviting you to join me on a road to truth via the path of non-contradiction. Join us each week on Feet to the Fire, a show with the goals of examining a subject matter on its own merits and test how it stands up to the many possibilities found in reality, all without pre-drawn conclusions found in personal bias. No left or right wings here. No pounding the pulpit of ego-driven my way or the highway attitudes. But there are no free passes given either. Answers to questions are important, but equally important is the reasons and methods used to find the answer. The lack of contradiction is the final judge here. On Feet to the Fire, Sunday evenings, live. Do you listen? www.feettofire.com for more information.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
You are listening to Through the Keyhole with host Karen Dolan. I'm Richard Dolan, guest hosting for my lovely wife today. Folks, this is my first show for Paranormal Radio Network, and you know what? My first show as host of any radio show. I'm very proud to have as my first guest, a truly extraordinary man. His name is Richard Souter, author of several really excellent books, most notably Underground Bases and Tunnels, Underwater and Underground Bases, Kundalini Tales. This is a man that I have known as a researcher for pushing 4 or 5 years now, I think. Richard and I first met online. He sent me an email as a result of some of my research. My book is UFOs and the National Security State. Richard had sent me an email giving me some analysis of modern America and connecting it to ancient Rome. I remember this like it was yesterday. And I remember thinking, well, this guy really thinks he knows a lot. Well, I think I know a lot about ancient Rome, too. What I discovered was that this man knew way more, far deeper, about ancient and modern history than I thought was possible for some other researcher in this field. Richard has surprised me and astounded me every time that I talk with him. I'm fortunate to be on the receiving end of some amazing long thought processes that he and I have on the phone. And so I want to introduce Richard Souter. Richard, are you there?
Yes, thank you. I am.
I have all of your books here in front of me. Underground Bases and Tunnels being your first one. And I just want to mention a couple of notes that I have off of this book, and the reason I think it's so important, it's a cautious book in some ways, and it's a very radical book in certain ways. In your research, you demonstrate a couple of very fundamental statements, very fundamental facts. One, that the technology necessary to build underground bases and tunnels is currently available, that is as of mid-1990s. Two, that the entrances to these tunnels are very easy to disguise, and so that they're nearly invisible to anyone who comes across them. Third, that the U.S. government makes use of this technology on a regular basis for who knows what purposes. Fourthly, these tunnels and bases are, at times, very deep beneath the surface of the earth, are quite sophisticated, very comfortable, and can accommodate large numbers of people. And here's a quote that you have in your book, which I think is really worth repeating. And that is, the aims and ideals of representative democracy are poorly served by secrecy in government. Dictatorships are born when power is usurped by the military. Do you remember writing that, Rich?
Yes, very well.
Well, I just think your book is extraordinary because, A, there's not a lot of information publicly available, or at least, let's say, easily available on underground bases, and yet you went out and did a book on this topic.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, you hit the nail on the head. I wrote, in effect, the book that I wanted to read but could not find in the libraries and in the bookstores.
What got you going?
That were open to the public. Pardon me?
What got you into the whole concept of underground bases?
Well, you know, perhaps I was given, you know, an initial push in that direction as a young child when I went away to school. You know, it was back in the early 60s, about 1961, when I went to first grade. And back then, they didn't have preschool and kindergarten in the rural South. And so I arrived at school not knowing how to count, not even knowing how to say ABC. I was a clean, blank slate.
Wow.
But I took to the process. Arithmetic was a mystery to me until the little girl in the next desk taught me how to count one day. The teacher's instructions proving completely impenetrable to my young mind. Reading and writing came a little easier to me, and I got good at it pretty fast, and I really enjoyed learning to read and to write, and I got so good at it that I was a very good speller. And I won most of the little spelling bees that we had in that two-room schoolhouse that I walked a mile to each way.
You were obviously
this
a fast
Eastern
learner.
Virginia. Pardon me?
You were obviously a fast learner.
Yeah. And so I won a spelling bee. And I was just a little kid, about 6 or 7 years old, and the teacher gave me a book as a prize, and it had to do with caves and spelunking. And, man, that really fired my imagination. I used to turn the pages in that book and look at the pictures
okay.
and imagine what it would be like to to go underground in those caves and see all those marvelous things. And so I guess that was an early formative experience, but it wasn't until years later when I had grown to adulthood and moved out to the Southwest to pursue my graduate studies that I heard people whom I encountered just in the course of my everyday life, not so much much at the university, but people that I met outside of the university for the most part, talking about rumors of secret underground tunnels and bases that were alleged to be in the southwestern part of North America. And this was pretty new to me. I had heard little, if anything, much about this before that time, and I thought these stories were peculiar. And then I had, for many years, been interested in UFOs, principally because my father was one of the, he belonged to APRO and to NICAP when I was a kid.
Major UFO organizations.
Yes, and, you know, back in the 50s and early 60s, these organizations were very active, and my father was a card-carrying member of, I think, both of them. To my knowledge, he was never any kind of officer or investigator, but he did get their literature and was had joined up. And so I had some of these things around the house when I was a kid growing up, and so I was aware that there were UFOs, and my dad was very interested. He always carried a camera in the car.
Well, what time period were we talking about here when you started learning about underground bases, or at least hearing rumors?
Moving into the late 1980s.
Okay.
So it's much later, you know, like 25, 30 years later. And
now, you didn't do any of this kind of work in graduate school, I assume.
No, no. To the contrary, it was the complete opposite.
I went through the same thing, man. A couple of years later, I was in graduate school and developed an interest in UFOs. And
no, this was
far
the in fact, my research in underground bases and tunnels has always had very little to do with UFOs.
Right.
Not because I don't think they're interesting, and not interesting and unworthy of study, but because I simply haven't found much hard documentation relating to them in pursuing my research on underground bases and tunnels.
So
nonetheless,
how did
you
start then?
Pardon me?
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have interrupted.
So
how did you get into the
I heard the stories, and I thought they were fascinating. And I also, at that time, Timothy Green Beckley was publishing a number of pulp UFO magazines, which you could find in the magazine rack of fine convenience stores everywhere. And so I used to read his magazines every 2 or 3 months. He'd come out with a new one. What were the titles of them? The Saucers Are Here. Weird titles, you know, how Timothy Green Beckley is. He's a character. But anyway, I used to buy these magazines, and they were not on my syllabi for my graduate seminars, I assure you, but I would buy them and read them, and he used to have articles in there by Talavask, and Talavask is a pseudonym, I believe, for Jason Bishop, and he and John Lear and others would have articles in there about these alleged underground tunnel networks in the Southwest with little gray bug-eyed aliens, you know, hurtling through them at high speed in a shuttle tube craft, and that the American military was involved with all of this. And so I was exposed to that in these types of magazines, but also I knew people in, you know, kind of New Agey circles in the Southwest that I encountered who were discussing similar things. And I thought it was all peculiar, and I thought, yeah, it sounds so strange, it can't possibly be true. But then on the other hand, I would tell myself, but suppose it is, or at least partially true.
And didn't you have a background doing mining for a while?
Well, yes. You know, earlier, in an earlier lifetime, I actually was a miner for about a year for Morton Salt down in one of their facilities on the Gulf Coast.
So you developed some knowledge of the technology of mining.
Well, yes. In fact, and most of the time I worked topside in the mill, but for a short period of time I did work underground in the mine, and you go down and on the bottom of a skip, the apparatus that brings the salt out of a deep mine is called a skip, and it comes straight up out of a vertical shaft from 800 feet down. It can bring out 20 tons of ore at a time. In this case, it was rock salt, And beneath the skip pit, there's what's called a man cage, which the miners enter, and there's a gate you close, and you go down, and you gain entrance to the mine that way.
I've got to think that was a helpful experience for you to get.
Well, it was, and of course, I think it goes along with my, there's always been kind of a residual or underlying interest in what's going on underground. Maybe a kind of an instinctive sense that there is something down there. But in any event, one of the things I learned working underground is it doesn't matter that you're down there hundreds of feet underground, almost 1,000 feet underground, that the salt mine has impressively large caverns. You have rooms that can be 150 feet tall or more and hundreds of feet long, and you have massive machinery down there, conveyor belts, and of course there's high explosives and a lot of it. And then you have trucks that can carry 20 tons of salt at a time. Mammoth trucks with wheels higher than a 6-foot man is tall, and just massive, powerful machinery. So this is eye-opening. It revealed to me that you can be driving around in the Deep South, for example, out in the marshes, and never know that hundreds of feet beneath you there are men working around the clock, that there is a massive industrial operation going on, that there is huge, powerful machinery gouging and ripping away at the, you know, geological strata under there. And if you don't know that's going on, you won't have the faintest inkling that it's happening. So you see, it's a real simple point that needs to be made, but it's a powerful one. And by extension, it extends anywhere. In this case, I'm talking about rural Louisiana out in the marshes and swamps, but it could be extended to anywhere.
I got two observations here. One is that based on everything you've said about your background and your own interest in this, you are the guy who was meant to research this topic. It just seems to me that you were born to do that, maybe many other things, but certainly this. The other question that I have, though, is I think a lot of people would be surprised to suspect that there are such things as massive underground bases, mainly because they might think, How can people live down there? How can they get air, for example, and basic provisions being met without anybody knowing it, right?
Yes.
So how does that happen?
Well, quite easily. In fact, there are at any given time. Well, take the example of the salt mine that I worked in. Briefly underground, most of the time. Topside in the mill, but you have the shaft that the men and the salt go down and come up out of, and then you also have other shafts that serve as air shafts to draw fresh air in and to provide ventilation. So these air shafts can be actually camouflaged, and this was pointed out to me in the one of the conversations I had with one of my sources. And over the years, past 10 or 15 years, I've talked to an ever-growing number of people, some of whom have worked for the government, either in the military as uniformed military men or women, or as civilians working for or with the military, or as people who are not military and never were and never worked for the military, who are civilians and work in industry, or perhaps for another government agency.
Well, what is the big picture? What are the combined numbers of witnesses and leakers that you're getting? What are they telling you about the likely structure of the underground world?
Well, it comes in bits and pieces. And I suppose there's some of these. In fact, I know that there's some of them who have a much better picture of what's happening underground than I do, because I've never been an insider. I've never worked for any of the alphabet soup agencies. I've never had the security clearance. So I'm the guy with my nose pressed up against the glass looking in from the outside at a confusing kaleidoscopic pattern that is made confusing and kaleidoscopically confusing on purpose.
Okay, having said that,
and I'm trying to make sense of that. So some of the people I've talked to certainly have a far better idea of what's going on than I do.
Right.
However, even they would not have the complete picture because, as you discuss, I believe, in your work, And as I try to make clear in my work too, there is in the black world, and make no mistake about it, we're discussing the operations of the black world here.
Right.
Not the open world that we see and know in our everyday life, but a very hidden and world that is highly compartmentalized, such that literally the left hand does not know what the right hand is doing in this world.
Right. We are talking about the likelihood of massive amounts of secret money going into.
Yes, yes. Truly, this is the bottomless money pit, and there's no question that conservatively tens and hundreds of billions of dollars have been shoveled into underground programs and undersea programs as well. And it may even run into the trillions of dollars, and in fact, it would not surprise me if it did. The level of funding for this is massive. The amount of technology and the sophistication and power of the technology is mind-boggling. The number of people involved is certainly large. How large, I don't know, but conservatively it would run to the tens, maybe even the hundreds of thousands. At the high end, it may be that there are millions of people involved underground, Rich. We simply don't know the numbers. And what is clear to me from my research, reading the book of, the work of people like Fletcher Pruty, for example, who has the classic book, The Secret Team, which he published, I think, even all the way back already in the 1970s, maybe.
For those people who may not know, if they saw the movie JFK, character of Fletcher Pruty was portrayed almost to a T by Donald Sutherland in that penultimate scene at the end of the movie, where this mysterious CIA guy comes up to Kevin Costner's character, Jim Garrison, and sort of explains the workings of how the secret government works, right? That's Fletcher Pruty.
That in a nutshell. And Fletcher Pruty was worked at a very high level in the alphabet soup during the height of the Cold War. He told me that at the time of the JFK assassination, he was, and I talked with Fletcher Pruty personally, I found him to be a total sphinx, as I have so many of the people I've talked with.
A total what?
Sphinx.
S-P-H-I-N-X. Gotcha.
In other words, a cipher, a puzzle, a mystery within an enigma bound up inside a riddle, because that's the world he lived his professional and personal life in.
So you're saying he told you...
He told me that at the time of the JFK assassination, he was, I'm trying to remember, either on the way to the Antarctic or there. He was not altogether clear on why that was. Now, understand...
Why Antarctic?
Well, I don't know exactly. And you're dealing with Fletcher Pruty. And by the way, I've done a lot of research on the Antarctic. And let me tell you, from everything I've seen, there is something highly strange and highly secretive and highly important happening down there. I can't tell you what it is. I can only tell you there is an extreme security curtain that has been drawn about all things Antarctic. Why, I don't know, Rich, but there's a heavy military presence down there, and there has been for decades. I mean, American military.
I remember years ago when I first very tentatively started looking into the UFO mysteries in the early 90s. I'd heard rumors immediately about Antarctica, and
I think there's a lot going down there in many different spheres
I spoke to a man here in where I live in the Rochester area who told me very explicitly about his older brother who had been down in Antarctica on a highly classified mission that he had reason to believe had to do something with extraterrestrials or related phenomena.
Maybe. That's a tangential line we could pursue later if you like. But getting back to Fletcher Pruty, he was at the height of the Cold War, like the 50s, 60s, 70s, that period there, worked as a liaison between the highest level of the Pentagon and the CIA. And he also told me that he was personally involved at a high level and a seminal level with Operation Paperclip back in the late 40s after World War II. So he was a player at highest levels of the military-industrial espionage complex, and had his finger into a lot of these pots. And I bring him up because in his book he made an interesting observation. He talks in his book, The Secret Team, a lot about special operations. And he said, already then, this was a quarter of a century ago, there were something like hundreds of compartmentalized CIA units embedded within the formal structure of the Pentagon, within the organization of the Army, the Marines, the Navy, and Air Force. And they were saying that their own...
Let's make sure people understand what you're saying here. The CIA has embedded itself within many, many other aspects of the U.S. government and military. That is what he was saying.
Big time.
Okay.
Hugely. Hugely. Like an octopus. And I believe he actually uses that word long before Danny Casolaro, with his research, used the same word. But I think they both used it in a similar way.
The CIA was spread out throughout, covertly throughout much of, really, let's say, for all intents and purposes, the entire U.S. national security government apparatus.
Well, and what the point he's making is that then, when you look, and he made this by implication, but it's staring you in the face, when you have literally several hundred secret CIA units seated throughout the military structure, wearing military uniforms, be they, Navy, Marines, Air Force, Army, and ostensibly under military command and in the military command structure, however, carrying out highly secretive, black-funded, compartmentalized operations that are actually outside of the formal military chain of command,
right.
and in many, perhaps most, maybe even all cases, operating without the knowledge of the military command structure, maybe even in contravention to their orders, that poses a problem. And you see, that's the situation we have, where the American military at this point essentially is a hybrid organization. It is military, and it is also CIA, an unknown and unknowable measure.
Okay. Now, let's get back to the underground base connection, though.
I am, and I mentioned Fletcher Prudy because early in my research, starting all the way back in the summer of 1992, so I'm going back 15 years here, and that's when I started my research, the summer of 1992, June of 1992, I had taken a trip. I had done a little bit of documentary research, and I had discovered that from open source documents that there was some continuity of government underground facilities in the Middle Atlantic region in Virginia and Maryland and Pennsylvania and so forth. And I actually had some pretty good directions for some of them. I found these in a book by William Arkin, who is now a national security writer for the Washington Post, but he's been writing about national security, military affairs for the last 15 or 20 years.
Okay.
And anyway, I got one of his publications, and he indicated that there was an underground base in the town of Warrenton, Virginia, which is in northern Virginia, south of Washington, D.C., about a half an hour, 45-minute drive, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he indicated that it was occupied, this underground facility was occupied by an unknown agency. So I thought, well, that's enough. Warrenton's not that big a town. I'll go, and I'm from Virginia, by the way, originally, so I decided I'll drive up there, and I'll just look around and see if I can find anything.
Sure.
So I drove to Warrenton, and it's still a fairly small, rural town, so I didn't know where to go. I stopped at a convenience store for some gas and cold drink because it was the summer and it was a little hot. And so I went in and I bought something out of the cooler and I went to the counter and paid for my gas. And I asked the clerk as I was paying if she knew anything about a federal government underground base in or near Warrenton, Virginia. And she was a middle-aged woman. She drew a total blank. She told me that, no, she didn't know anything about that. She'd never heard anything about it. And I could see from the expression on her face that she was truly clueless.
Okay.
Now, in just that instant, there were a couple of teenagers, maybe 15, 16, behind me, who had come in just after me, and I also got some cold drinks out of the cooler. And they piped up and said, excuse us, mister, yeah, we know what you're talking about. So I turned around, and I said, well, you know, what is it? And they said, well, which one do you want? And I said, well, why don't we start with the first one and proceed from there? And I said, okay, yeah, well, if Station A is at such and such a place, and Station B is at, you know, this other place. I said, well, why don't you give me driving directions to both of them?
Right.
And they did, and it turns out when I arrived that that they were telling me about Warrenton Army Station, Training Station A and B. Stations A and B. So I got chased away from...
Now, what did it look like?
Well, it's like an army base. At the front, at the entrance, there's a guard shack at Station A, which is right on the outskirts of town on a secondary road. It's very beautiful, picturesque, rolling Virginia countryside. It's wonderful. It's
So you're saying you couldn't really see anything from that
ground? Well, no, you could see a military-style security fence like you see around most military facilities and a lot of other government facilities. And but inside, it looked almost park-like. I did notice some utility poles, and one of them had massive electrical conduits coming down the side of it and going right into the ground. I mean, thick electrical cables.
Right, that's quite suggestive.
Well, it was to me.
Yeah.
And so then I continued driving around the place until I came to a guard station. And so I decided I would just take a picture. I had a camera with me of the guard station and the sign saying Warrenton Army Training Station. And so I did.
Yes.
Well, the guard came rushing out of the guard shack, and he came running across the road and said, no, you can't photograph this place. And this was before 2001. This was 1992. And I said...
Yeah.
Why not? And he said, because I said so. Well, of course, he's armed, and he's carrying a badge, and there were some other policemen, not in military uniform, inside the fence, but they were also armed.
Yeah.
And they, I don't know what police force or paramilitary force they belonged to.
Maybe those were the guys who put the whack in Whack-a-Hut.
Maybe. They were not in any military-style uniform. Neither were they wearing a sheriff's or local cop type of uniform, a state police type of uniform. But they were armed, and they looked menacing, and they were moving in my direction. So I said, okay. I started my car and drove away, and I went, then you see, to Station B.
Yes.
Where I didn't see any similar guard shack, where the gate was open, in fact, but I didn't drive through it. I didn't want to provoke any more encounters of the unpleasant kind.
Indeed.
But I did take a
guard
photo.
Guard Station B did not have very much to notice about the
guard. It had some massive antennas and aerials there around the backside of Station B. The front was very unremarkable. The front gate was open at Station B. I didn't drive through it. Because even if there's not a guard, once you're on a military reservation, you're subject to their rules and regulations.
So, now...
So, wait a minute. There's more. When I arrived around the back of Station B, I pulled up, and there was a cherry red Stingray Corvette parked in the middle of this country lane, which was not a secondary road. It was a smaller McAdam type of track, almost, if you will, that's common in the rural South. And so this cherry red Corvette Stingray with dark tinted windows rolled up was just parked there, quietly idling in the middle of the road. Clearly my arrival was expected. Mm-hmm. However, this is not a military vehicle.
Right, right.
And it's not exactly what you expect to see on a quiet country road in the Virginia countryside. So I got out of my car, and I figured, well, someone's waiting for me. How charming, you know? How sociable. How welcoming. So I started to walk over to this Corvette, and nothing happened. But as I got just a few steps away, it eased into first gear and began to creep away from me.
No kidding.
So I figured, oh, they don't want to chat, eh? Well, I'll just see about that. So I walked a little faster. The Stingray Corvette drove just that much faster. So I figured, I gotta speed up here if I'm gonna do this thing. So I broke into a dog trot. Don't you know the Stingray Corvette accelerated just a little bit more to keep just 10 or 15 feet in front of me. So I figured, okay, playing hard to get, eh? So I broke into a little bit of a stride, see? And it just accelerated a little more. So I figured, well, I'm going to try to catch this thing. You know, like a barking dog?
Yeah.
I'm going to catch this car. I'm going to physically grab hold of it. So I started sprinting after it, at which point it accelerated, you know,
right.
Typical 0 to 60 in 5 seconds.
Right.
And zoomed off into the distance down this road and disappeared around the bend in the road. Now, whoever was in that car under no circumstances wanted Richard Souter to see their face.
Exactly.
Either I know that person, right?
Yeah, okay.
And they didn't want me to recognize that they had me under surveillance or something. Somehow they knew I was there. Or they didn't know me, but thought that we might in the future cross paths, and they would not want me to recognize them in the future.
Very, very good point. I'm here with Richard Souter, incidentally, for those of you just joining in Paranormal Radio Network. My name's Rich Dolan. I'm guest hosting for my wife, Karen Dolan. You're listening to the show Through the Keyhole. Richard, I love talking with you. Normally we do these conversations privately, and now we're doing it in front of thousands of listeners. I would like to ask, so how did your research continue?
Well, let me follow out that, because with the Fletcher Pruda connection. So in the late 90s, about 5 years later, I was living in the Washington, D.C. area, and I actually just called Fletcher Pruda up on the phone. And I found out his name from a mutual associate, his phone number, and I just called him up, and he wasn't floored in the slightest. I taught him what I was researching, what I was doing,
right.
And he talked with me, and I asked him specifically about that facility because I thought with his Washington connections and Alphabet Soup connections, he might know something, and I said, listen, I told him about the facility, and I said, I have not been able to find a record of this Army facility in any publication of the American government. This is the Army base that does not exist. Why? And he says, well, you have to understand that Army base is not an Army base. It's a CIA base.
Oh.
It is actually a CIA base.
He just comes out and tells you.
Yeah. He said, and so I asked him more about the facility, and he said, well, now you're getting into the realm of special operations. And I said something like, do tell, like I haven't figured that out already.
Right.
But he really wouldn't elaborate much more on that, other than to say, yeah, the sign out front says Army, and the guard looks like he has an Army uniform on. Howsomever, that is not an Army base. That is, in fact, a CIA, an underground CIA installation.
No, I mean, in the early 1990s, I mean,
let me make a subsidiary point here before we go on.
Sure.
Parenthetical point, and that is, just because you look at a government installation, therefore, and it says Army, or Marines, or Navy, or anything else, it doesn't have to mean that just because the sign says something, that the nature of the base or the operation of the base has anything to do at all with what the sign says.
Very good point. And I was just thinking in the early 1990s, this was even more radical than it is today. I think today there are certain people who are a little more willing to recognize that their government isn't really what it appears to be. But I just think in the early 90s, this was not necessarily as widespread an assumption.
The lies are so thick and goopy rich that you could slice them with a butter knife.
How deep do these lies go? I mean, literally, how deep do some of these bases go?
Very, Sorry. In fact, my research, I have to tell you, from that point, starting in the 90s, I've never stopped working on this, and I just keep chipping away at it by bits and pieces. And I found out a surprising amount of information. And I have to believe if one man, with no resources and just his spare time, no security clearances, has been able to discover what I have been able to on an occasional part-time basis, that I certainly have only uncovered the proverbial tip of the iceberg. And what I have found by going to the open literature, I don't have any classified stuff, by going to the open literature, whether it's government archives, federal document collections at major libraries, whether they're public or university or private libraries, or by going to government agencies and looking through their files that are open to the public or the National Archives, or just looking through the academic and scientific literature and engineering literature, even reading general interest books, articles, and newspapers, I have amassed piles of documentation. And what I have found out is these things can be very deep indeed. It's nothing to go down 500 feet or 1,000 feet or even 2,000 or 3,000 feet. In fact, some of the literature that I have seen speaks of going down 3 miles to make land-occupied installations, whether they're tunnel systems or so forth. And I have to say, Rich, that I believe that there are women down there, too, certainly, because most men don't want to spend appreciable periods of time apart from women. We crave female companionship for a variety of reasons, and including the fact that women are just so lovely. And
It's just so true.
And so I now believe that it's entirely possible that there is a resident subterranean and also subsea submarine population, if you will.
A couple of things, man, I just interject here. One, I myself have heard a number of stories, including firsthand as well as through other researchers, about evidence for long-term habitation underground, just as you're suggesting here. The other thing I want to ask you is, I have attended a number of your lectures. We've spoken at a number of the same conferences. And you have spoken and you've written about undersea bases. You were just kind of getting into this now. And I really wonder if you can describe to people just why this isn't as crazy as it sounds. I mean, when people think about underwater bases, I think the instinct is to assume, oh, that's just not possible. How can you do that? I think you've demonstrated in a lot of your research that, A, it is possible, and B, it's likely. Is that so?
Not only that, but starting at least 50 years ago, more than 40 years ago, the United States Navy itself, and this is from the open literature, published a study that came out of the China Lake, then called China Lake Naval Weapons Station, in eastern California, over towards the Nevada line. There's a huge, sprawling naval base, and it's well inland. A lot of people don't realize the Navy does a lot of stuff above and beyond sailing ships and submarines around.
Right. Yeah, China Lake, that's our desert country, really.
It's very desertous.
Right.
Very desertous. It's a very tight, almost a lunar landscape over there when you get right down to it.
What is the Navy doing out there?
All kinds of things. They do a lot of basic research, including, surprisingly, geological research. And the Navy actually back then published something called the Rock Site Plan or the Rock Site Study. The Rock Site meaning they were planning even then, in the mid-1960s, to go down into the rock beneath the ocean floor in mid-ocean. We're talking going to thousands of feet of open sea and then going thousands of feet down into the solid bedrock beneath the seafloor and there making manned and womaned, because the document speaks openly about stationing families out there.
Unbelievable. You're going down. How deep is the Pacific? How much water is between?
Well, here's how they would go.
Is it a mile or more?
The Rock Site Study sent out three means by which this could be done. and using existing 1960s era technology, and easily. None of it was exotic, and the study made clear that the machinery to do this and technology to do it already existed, was off the shelf in the mining and petroleum industries in the mid-1960s, and all that had to be done was to put it together in a novel way that had not been done before, not because it couldn't be done, but just because it had not been done.
You're saying open literature sources showed the technological feasibility of doing that as early as 40 plus years ago.
Yes. And
how do you get
there? The three ways in which it could be done was, number one, use then-existing tunnel boring machines. And tunnel boring machines, for people who haven't seen them or haven't seen pictures of them, are something like huge mechanical earthworms. They can range in diameter anywhere from, you know, 2 or 3 feet up to 40 or 50 feet or more in diameter. And they're circular, usually. They rotate, and they can be hundreds of feet long, and they have thousands of horsepower. They are tremendously powerful pieces of machinery, and what they do is they chew their way through the rock and the soil deep underground. This can be hundreds, even thousands of feet underground, and they make a circular tunnel.
Is it true that they don't necessarily need, that like the dirt doesn't have to be carried out to the surface? Is there a way to dig so that the dirt is just down there somehow and out of the way?
Well, there's conventional tunnel boring machines that would then have an apparatus with conveyor belts and so forth to carry the resulting spoil or muck that was excavated from the face of the tunnel out the back, and then would be carried away either by a narrow gauge railway in the tunnel or by trucks or a conveyor belt system, which could be miles long, by the way, until they would be dumped out at the end of the tunnel. That's one way to get rid of it. Now the Los Alamos National Lab in northern New Mexico back in the late 1970s did some feasibility studies and some R&D, research and design work, on so-called nucleus terrenes, which are designed to use a nuclear-powered machine to sort of slice through the rock. It melts it into a vitreous type of substance that would resemble volcanic glass, obsidian, in other words.
I see.
And it's so hot, the face of the tunnel boring machine would be so hot that it would melt the rock as it went along and plaster it then against the sides of the tunnel, and you would get a very smooth tunnel, a glassy type of tunnel, in other words.
Is it essentially pushing the dirt, I mean packing it through to the sides and above?
It would be rock. The pressure of the machine would force this out at great pressure into fractures in the rock as it went along, which would have the effect of making a very strong tunnel. With smooth glass-like walls that would essentially be man-made obsidian, very very similar to that, and it would be of great structural integrity. Whether this has been done, I can't prove. If it's been done, it's been done in the black world.
Right. Okay. But the feasibility was about 30 years ago.
Yes. And I do have those records. They're public. In fact, the engineers and scientists who did this work patented these things, and they're official United States patents issued for the technology, and they have a lot of nice depictions in there of what these machines would look like if they were built. If they were built, the whole thing was taken black.
Okay, now, before we take our break, which is in 10 minutes, here's what I would love for us to do. I would love to get a sense from you as to where some of the major bases that you suspect might be.
Everywhere.
Everywhere. And then for the second half, I'm hoping we get into more black budget issues.
Well, let me give you a quick thumbnail of where some of the publicly known underground installations are. I know them. I know they're there. The Russians know they're there. The Chinese know they're there. The French know they're there. Everyone knows they're there because you can read about it in open source documents and literature. And in many, some of these have been discussed, in fact, a lot of them in newspaper articles and books, and even featured in some cases in movies. Okay, some of the major known underground installations or bases: Raven Rock, on the border between Maryland and Pennsylvania, sometimes called the alternate command center, or alternate Pentagon. There's the well-known Mount Webb base that FEMA controls. This is in Northern Virginia, about an hour's drive outside of Washington, D.C. There is the NORAD base in Colorado. There is the Thunder Bay base, the former NORAD base, up north in northern Ontario, run jointly by the Canadians and Americans. I believe it was decommissioned a few years ago. There are a number of FEMA underground bases around the country. There's the one at at Olney, in suburban Washington, D.C., near Olney, Maryland, on Riggs Road.
A question here. There was someone who a little while back asked if you'd heard any rumors or anything about an underground base at Fort Huaca in Arizona.
No, I don't have specific information, but I would give you better than 50% odds that there is one there, because a lot of major military bases do have an underground component, and that is a major base for the Army and has been for years. And so I do suspect there's a good chance there's one there. I don't have any specific documentation on that myself, no.
Okay. It's Fort Huachuca, sorry.
But yes, Fort Huachuca. It's down in southern Arizona. But, and then there are others around the country, the FEMA installations, and I detail a number of these in my book. It's well known there's a major deep facility beneath the White House. It's been there at least since the Johnson years.
Describing that in one of your talks, as a matter of fact.
And in my first book as well. In fact, I know a person who's been in there years ago and went way down. And even then, in the mid-1960s, it went down at least 17 levels, which means that even in the 1960s, going back 40 years, driving down Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House, you look at the White House and you think, oh, wow, that's big, you know. The president's in there, never suspecting that there is a literal anthill going down and down and down and down and down, level after level after level after level below that.
Unreal. Is it possible to estimate how many underground bases there may be either in the United States or the world?
I don't know. I think it's real hard.
It is. Do you think there's more than 50 in the United States? I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah.
More than 100?
Possibly. And here's the thing, Rich.
It's not only
the military that has underground facilities. Certainly the military agencies have their underground facilities.
Right.
Some of them are known. I have to believe a lot of them are not publicly known. But in addition to the military, you have other agencies in the federal government and state governments and local government. You have FEMA, which is a federal agency. It's well known FEMA has a whole suite of underground facilities, you know, here and there around the country. But there's the Department of Energy, and there's, you know, many other agencies.
The Department of Energy has had a major presence at the fabled Groom Lake facility, Area 51.
Well, in Nevada. I mean, from everything I hear and have read and intuit and have been told, there's a lot underground in Nevada, but not only in Nevada, you see. There's the Bureau of Land Management, there's the Bureau of Indian Affairs, or there's the Interior Department, many different federal agencies. And most of them have their own underground facility or facilities related to the continuity of government plan, so-called COG plan. There's the COG Federal ARC, spelled A-R-C, but it's clearly a pun on Noah's Ark of federal underground facilities within the Mid-Atlantic region of the United States, and these facilities are intended for use by these agencies in the event of some kind of national emergency or catastrophic upheaval.
Right. So a Noah's Ark for those people who are able to
them.
Use it.
And if you have a Jeep card, you have access to those. There's a Jeep 1 card and a Jeep 2 card. Now, they're not for everyone. Not everyone who works with the federal government, whether in a military agency or one of the other agencies, has a Jeep card. If you have a Jeep card, it means when the sloppy stuff hits the fan, you'll have access to one of these underground facilities, or you can get into the tunnel system. If you don't have a Jeep card, whether one or two, you will be hung out to dry and will fend for yourself, and you and yours as best as you can. Now, the Jeep 1 card means that someone will come to get you a van or a chauffeur, or you'll be able to go somewhere and get on a bus, something like that,
yeah.
And be ferried to your assigned underground location. If you have a Jeep, Jeep 1 card, a Jeep 2 card means that a helicopter will be sent round to pick you up. Now, clearly, the people with the helicopter rides are considered more important in the pecking order than those who have to get to by more pedestrian means.
Yeah.
But if you don't have a Jeep card, or you have to ask, hey, by the way, what's a Jeep card? You may safely assume you are not in on the know, and you will not be hustled underground with the rest of them. You will be left topside
indeed
to make your own way. And I think, Rich, sadly, or maybe happily, you and I don't have Jeep cards.
No, I do not, Rich. I've occasionally been trying to lobby my way in. No, just kidding. I don't think I want to.
So anyway, some of these are. I will tell you that most any major military base, as I found out, even extremely minor military bases that, by the way, are not even military bases, have underground facilities.
Now, do you think that they are also worldwide, like in other countries,
yes,
for example, Europe, Asia, Africa, other
countries? Well, a little known thing is that the Bechtel Corporation during the 1980s...
One of the largest constructing corporations in the world.
Sometimes called the fourth branch of the American government.
Indeed.
It's very powerful and interfaces very closely with the United States federal...
Making a fortune on the current wars.
It interfaces seamlessly with the military-industrial espionage complex in this country and right around the world. But during the 1980s, the Bechtel Corporation, using black funding, made very deep, large, and sophisticated underground bases in Saudi Arabia as part of the infrastructure that was installed for the upcoming planned war, or as we're now saying, wars, or maybe it's all one long 15-year war against Iraq. That was part of the infrastructure that was put in. What I'm telling you and the audience is that wars don't just happen. They are made to happen, and major wars are planned years, maybe even decades, maybe even centuries in advance. They are known, they are planned, they are arranged for, the infrastructure is put in for them well before the first shot is fired. Religious organizations that have their own underground facilities.
What we've really gone, I mean, your work is just, it's an odd combination, an amazing combination of conservatism and radicalism, it seems to me, because your research itself is very conservative.
Yes, it is.
In the sense that you never overreach. I've read all of your books, and you're very right on target with what is possible, what things look like in terms of, what were the plans that were being laid out in the 1960s and 70s, and what were the technologies available, and then...
I went right to the government's own documentation.
Right. But then the implications of what you're saying really turn upside down so many of the things that we like to believe about the nature of our own society.
We're living in a dream world.
Indeed. So let's take a break right now. I'm getting a signal from our producer that let's take a break when we're ready. So why don't we do that now, and then we'll pick it up right after that. You're listening to Paranormal Radio Network.com. This is Rich Dolan, guest hosting for my wife Karen Dolan on Through the Keyhole. We'll be right back.
Rumors spreading around in that Texas town about the shack outside the game. And you know what I'm talking about. Just let me know if you wanna go to that home out on the range. They got a lot of nice girls.
this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
To UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Get your dose of truth with the Truth Hurts Radio Show with your host, Charles Giuliani, Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern. The truth hurts. Ignorance kills.
Perspective. We all have one. Our entire view of the world is based on it. Welcome to the Unabridged Universe. We invite you to set your perspective aside for a moment and join us on a refreshing journey into aspects of your universe that you may not have noticed from your particular point of view. Let host Jason Wilson be your guide into the corners of the universe you've never peeked into before. Who knows? You may just enjoy it and end up coming back for more. Take a stroll into the Unabridged Universe, live Saturdays from 7 to 9 Central Standard Time. Only on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Do you like to ask questions about everything? Would you like to escape from your proverbial box? Just leap out and explore our world in ways you've never imagined? You can have that opportunity. As we grow and expand, new features will be added, allowing you to experience radio programming at a fresh new level. I invite you to join me, November Hansen, host of Voice of the People. Together, we can expand our horizons and peer into multifaceted possibilities. This program will broadcast live Saturday evenings on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, this is James Arthur Janczyk, the Black Knight of Talk Radio, inviting you to join me on a road to truth. Be the path of non-contradiction. Join us each week on Feet to the Fire, a show with the goals of examining a subject matter on its own merits and test how it stands up to the many possibilities found in reality, all without pre-drawn conclusions found in personal bias. No left or right wings here. No pounding the pulpit of ego-driven my way or the highway attitudes. But there are no free passes given either. Answers to questions are important, but equally important is the reasons and methods used to find the answer. The lack of contradiction is the final judge here. On Feet to the Fire, Sunday evenings, live. How do you listen? www.feettofire.com for more information.
Light up your night with the Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Dolan. I'm guest host for my wife, Karen Dolan. You're listening to Through the Keyhole Radio here on ParanormalRadioNetwork.com. My guest is Dr. Richard Sauder. Richard has a PhD in political science. When did you get that, Rich?
Back on 95, something like that.
Back in ancient times. That's when dinosaurs still roamed the earth, as I recall.
Yeah.
You and I started our research into fringy types of topics actually around the same time because you were telling us in the last hour that you started really diving into this, I think, in 1992 or so. It was only a 2 years later, I think in 94, that I really started to dive into UFO studies in a serious way. I just think that's kind of interesting that our careers have gone basically along a similar timeline.
Yeah.
Looking into some different things. One thing that we're both interested in is black budget matters, and I have to say, let me just tell anyone who's listening, that a lot of my impetus for going into this has been due to a lot of input that you've made. So one thing that I would like to start this hour off is by giving a bit of information that I think a lot of people are not aware of. And it is this. In July of 2001, during the early months of the Bush administration, this is all brand new, right? Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was talking to the House Armed Services Committee for appropriations for the next year's fiscal budget. So he's talking about all the things that the Pentagon needed and was talking about the financial mess that he had inherited from the previous administration. Okay, that's all pretty typical, standard, you'd expect that. Here's the bombshell. He drops this nearly at the end of several hours of talking with the House, and he says, according to some, he says the finances are so snarled up in the Pentagon that according to some estimates, we cannot track $2.6 trillion in transactions. That's Rumsfeld talking to the House. Now that's, you might hear such a number and you think, well, that has to be a mistake. Until a congressman repeated it, and the Pentagon corrected it shortly after that and brought it down to $2.3 trillion. Now, to get a sense of perspective on this, the Pentagon's budget for fiscal year 2001 had been $310 billion, about one-eighth the amount that Rumsfeld was saying they could not track. Richard, you and I both know Catherine Austin Fitz, former Assistant Secretary of Housing and Urban Development at HUD, under the first Bush administration back in the early 90s. And she said that when she learned about this, this was right before 9/11, she heard that and she said, this is going to be enough to bring the house down. Then came 9/11, and that number was just gone.
Yeah.
Gone. What is going on with the Pentagon?
Well, as a matter of fact, there was an article that CBS published the day before the notorious 9/11 attacks in 2001,
right,
in which this very factoid was discussed, and then the very next day, the 9/11 attacks were unleashed, and this very uncomfortable fact has yet to surface again to any meaningful degree.
According to Catherine, she said that, and I didn't get this confirmed, but she said that the topic of the missing money became off limits formally for national security purposes.
Quite possible, because who knows when you started tracing that money what trails you would go down and what you might discover at the end of those trails.
Exactly.
You might discover compartmentalized projects, you might discover grand theft at the highest levels of the American power establishment, you might discover ties between criminal syndicates and government agencies rich. It could all be very unpleasant if you're a senator, for example, or if you are an admiral or a general, or, God forbid, the president, actually the president of the United States, and you get caught with your hand in a multi-trillion-dollar cookie jar. That'd be highly embarrassing.
We can safely say that if they were truly to investigate that amount of missing money, none of those people would be happy with what would be discovered.
I don't think so, because at the very least, it would reveal criminal incompetence on their part, and it would only get worse from there. That would be the best scenario.
Yeah.
Because, suppose you were dragged in for an audit by the IRS, and you said, and they asked you to account for your finances, and you said, well, guess what? I just can't.
Yeah.
That's
just
simple fact of the matter. I can't tell you, you know, that money you're mentioning, I just don't know. No, I don't have the foggiest notion where it meant, where it went, where it came from, what happened to it. Cannot tell you.
I'd love to be able to say, well, that's a matter of national security. I can't tell you.
Well, but in the case of the... So why do we take it from the Pentagon?
Right.
And they come every year and want money.
I don't know.
And then there are trillions of dollars missing, and they say, you know what? We have auditors, we have people with financial oversight, and we just cannot tell you where trillions of dollars went, and yet the people of this country have accepted that.
Well, I think most people in this country don't know, and I have been trying, and maybe you can do this. I don't know if you're able to answer this either, but I have been trying for several years to wrap my little brain around this fact. 2-point-whatever trillion dollars is multiple times that of the annual Pentagon budget. So the question, of course, is, well, there's many questions that come up here. How is it possible to lose 8 times your annual budget? I mean, over...
let me cut to the chase here. It hasn't been lost. There are people who know where that money is and what was done with it. You can't simply lose trillions of dollars. And for Donald Rumsfeld to say that with a straight face, and actually didn't with a straight face, if you read the transcript of that congressional hearing, you will... It says in the transcript that they were laughing about it.
Well, that's right. The transcript is in the public domain. Anyone can look this up, guys. Go right ahead. Search it out. He mentioned the figure, and then he cracked a joke, basically saying that, I'll have to look it up, but it was too hot to handle. The handle was kind of hot, and he made some kind of humorous quip about it, and there was chuckling in the house. If I were a congressman, I'd just be thinking, whoa, stop, back up, say what, 2-point what trillion?
But you know, Rich, none of them did, and it was dropped there, never to be discussed again by the Congress of the United States.
It's astonishing. It's
well, it means that our government is bought and sold. They're just a bunch of dithering do-nothings, whether it's in the Congress or the Pentagon or the executive branch. They're criminals, they're thieves, they're liars, they're incompetents, and those are the good things I can say about them.
Well, I know that you're a very gracious and charming person in real life, so, folks, you have to believe him. Listen,
what are we dealing with here? We're dealing with people who have stolen trillions of dollars from us to our face. What can you say good about that?
No, nothing. And, you know, clearly I wanted to bring this up because it's my own suspicion, I know it's yours, that this is really what's funding so much of the stuff that you and I both research.
It has to be.
Right. And there's no appropriations officially indicated in the federal budget, either for, let's say, UFO research or for underground-based secret facility construction. I mean,
or for building transatlantic or trans-Pacific sub-ocean floor tunnel networks and living accommodations for, you know, thousands of people. It's not there. I've gone through numerous budget documents and, reams of financial information, and you will find no such thing. What this means is that in reality, when I said earlier that we're living in a dream world, I wasn't joking. I wasn't just making conversation. I mean that things are not as we have been told.
Indeed.
The reality that we believe is reality. Guess what, folks? Things are vastly different than that. We are being lied to, and massively. We are being stolen from. We are being robbed, and massively. We are being used. We are being gotten over on. we are being exploited and trampled on, and I mean big time.
Yeah. Well.
And to take this further, what I did find in searching through the budget documentation was that in the early 1980s, I found a puzzling reference to something called the Albuquerque Operations Service. And it was something like the 45th largest contractor to the United States federal government in one budget year in the 1980s. And when I found this document, I thought, well, how strange. I've never heard about this because it was in a list of the 100 largest contractors with the federal government that year. And other entities on the list were things like the Goodyear Tire Corporation,
sure.
General Electric, you know, Exxon, oil.
Corporations that everyone knows.
Fortune 500 corporations. And then in the midst of all of this, I started noticing there were also some government agencies. And I was wondering, how can a government agency be a contractor to the federal government? Doesn't it work the other way around? Government agencies being part of the federal government would have corporations that would contract with them, but how is it that the government agencies can actually be contractors for the federal government unless it is the case that the government itself is a corporation?
Well, that's good logic.
But beyond that, this Albuquerque Operations Service really caught my eye because I was living in Albuquerque, and I'd heard of no such animal, and the amount of money involved was very large. And I thought that certainly if there was a company named that in Albuquerque, certainly it would attract a lot of attention, and I hadn't heard anything about it. So I went to the librarians at the business school, at the business library, at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, and asked them. I showed them the documentation I had found, by the way, at the library, and asked them if they had heard of this entity or organization or corporation. They said they had not.
All right.
So at that point, I did an online search and found no mention of it anywhere. Now my radar is starting to beep.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
I then couldn't find out anything, so I decided to put it on the back burner, and I did for just a few years until I called the government agency that had published this budget information and asked them if they knew anything about it, and they said they didn't. And I said, well, look, you're the people who published this document, and this entity, whatever it is, Albuquerque Operations Service, appears on the list of these in this budget document. How can you tell me you don't know anything about it when you're the ones that published the document?
Good question.
Well, they couldn't answer my question, in fact, and or either couldn't or wouldn't. So I said, well, how do I find an answer to this? And they said, well, what you need to do is file a Freedom of Information Act request with the General Services Administration. Well, of course, the General Services Administration at that time, its name has since been changed, but was in charge of all buildings for the federal government, for the different federal agencies. So I did. I filed a FOIA request with the General Services Administration. Time passed, and I kind of forgot about it. And then one day I got this manila envelope with a computer printout for the Albuquerque Operations Service.
All right.
With contract data. And it turns out, and this is where you need to grab your suspenders to keep your pants from dropping off, that the Albuquerque Operations Service worked out of a post office box in Los Alamos.
A P.O. box in Los Alamos.
Yeah, the Albuquerque Operations Service was operating out of a post office box in Los Alamos, and the responsible party, or the P.O. box, was 5400. Los Alamos, New Mexico.
So it's were you able to find out?
87544. But it turns out that there was a name attached to it. It said Department of Energy, Undersecretary of Agency. Undersecretary of Energy.
Okay.
So, of course, the Department of Energy has a national lab in Los Alamos.
Right.
But it didn't say Los Alamos, you know, the national lab or Department of Energy in the budget data. It said the Albuquerque Operations Service. So it appears that the Albuquerque Operations Service was an operation being run by the Undersecretary of Energy through a post office box, 5400, in Los Alamos, New Mexico.
So according to any standard analysis of the
fiscal year 1982,
there would be an enormous amount of money, presumably going into Los Alamos National Labs, that was not known. That was not being tracked.
I don't know if this is being run by Los Alamos National Labs or not. All we have is a post office box.
Right, out of there.
In Los Alamos.
Can you assume or can you suspect that this has something to do with Los Alamos National Labs?
I have no idea.
Not, okay.
It may have been something, in other words, a national lab or tangential operations associated with it may simply be a way to launder vast sums of money for projects that may have little or nothing to do with the formal agenda of the national lab.
Well, and here's something to support that. Again, I'm going back to a lot of your really excellent research, and I remember you discussing how secrecy operates. There was a book, a fellow by the name of John Pena Craven and another
yes.
man named Bill Gully. Both of these people wrote about the nature of secrecy, one cover operation serving as cover for a deeper cover operation, which in
yes.
turn serves cover for even more. Can you describe a little bit of what you know about that?
Yes. Well, Gully was actually in charge of something called the military office in the White House. And understand, I have a doctorate in political science with a specialty in American politics. And in all of my graduate study, no one ever mentioned one word about this. It just didn't come up, principally because I suspect my professors themselves knew little or nothing about this.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, the military office is something that evidently has been associated with the office of the presidency, office of the president, the executive office of the president, going back to the 1950s at least, and maybe before. And Gully served in that office in one capacity or another at a very high level, starting, I think, in the Johnson years and continuing right up into the Carter era. And what Gully essentially says is that the President of the United States, any president, has at his disposal a virtually a bottomless pit of money, a slush fund, a black budget slush fund, if you will, that is virtually limitless in extent and scope. And with that, he can do almost anything he wants.
Didn't he make a lot out of the circuitous route of the money, right?
He did. And in the book, he points out that if you go to look for this in federal budget documentation, you will not find it because it is deep sixed. And what he says explicitly is that in his open remarks that were published in a book that was available for sale to the general public, is that the accounting that is used is so disingenuous, so circuitous, so,
so
fraudulent, that not even a skilled accountant would be able to ferret out the trail of the funding. And I believe the example he used was that the funding was run through some kind of Navy account having to do with an obscure Navy bureaucracy associated with the Chesapeake Bay, and then was that actually disposed of through some type of unassuming Army bureaucracy and none of it had anything to do with the White House per se, but vast sums of money could be and were funneled through that in his experience. And so he gives some examples of some of the things that presidents he worked for used that money to do. One may safely assume that there were other projects and escapades that he did not discuss in his published remarks. And I assume I'd be shocked if that similar arrangement didn't continue to the present day and is being used for a great many things. One thing that he does mention in his book, which was directly germane to my research, is that during the period that he was associated with the military office in the White House, one of the things that was done was to build a series of very deep underground or deeply buried underground facilities all over the country intended for the use of the president in an emergency situation. Evidently, there were scores of them built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and one would assume there may be even more today. Now, he didn't reveal any of the locations. I believe that I do know some of them, just based on my research, but that was one example that he gave, and all of that was done secretively and secretly using what amounts to black budget funding being run through a military bureaucracy that interfaced directly with the executive office of the president, that the general public then and even now knows practically nothing about.
Well, it really hammers home the whole point about the fictitious nature of our own government spending, our so-called government spending, when you have every year the President and Congress go through the same procedure trying to hammer out a budget, when in reality what it looks like is that there's equal or greater amounts of money.
When you go to the library or a federal documents collection and you ask the archivists, you know, I'd like to look at the budget documents for the United States government for such and such a year, and they'll help you find track it down with finding aid,
right.
And they'll take you, and you can bring out how many hundreds of pages these documents are, and you can flip through it. Let me tell you, friends, you are looking at some of the finest fiction that man has ever produced.
Yeah.
You're looking at, you know, you read a Tom Clancy novel, and it is fiction. I suggest when you look at these federal government documents, like the official budget of the United States, that, my friends, is fiction intended for the general confusion of the public.
Back in the 1930s, I used to do, I used to study Soviet history in the 1930s. I wasn't alive in the 1930s, let me clarify. But one thing that I remember really going into were Soviet population figures of the 1930s, and the reason it's so interesting is that in reality in the Soviet Union there was a massive famine that was killing millions of people in Ukraine, very much so, and also many other parts of the Soviet Union. None of those numbers were reflected, however, in official Soviet population statistics, so that the I think the 1939 census said there was 170 million people, when in reality what we now believe is that the number was about 156 million, a deficit of 14 million people. And yet through the decades, through the 1950s and 60s and 70s and 80s and into the 90s, until it started to change, every textbook, every book, I had several books that dealt with Soviet population, they all maintained the fiction of this 170 million. And this
well,
is how
not only the Soviets from decades ago in the 20th century, in this country today, no one knows how many people are here. We have official population figures, and I used to work with demographic data in my graduate studies to a certain extent, and I work with census data quite a bit. And I would suggest equally, as with the federal budget data, when you were looking at the census report, to a degree, it also is fiction, because not even the Census Bureau knows how many people are in the country. How many illegal aliens are here? No one knows.
Read
estimates from government agencies themselves that differ by millions of people. And that's just one sector of the people who are in the United States at this point. Let me give you an example. At the occasional last census in the year 2000. I won't mention the name of the town, but it's a town where I had occasion to go I had business there from time to time, and I knew a man who lived and worked there, and I would stop at his place of business sometimes. He is now deceased, by the way, but he was a friend and an associate, and I would go to see him sometimes. And he operated a store, and upstairs from there was a grand staircase right in the middle of the store, and I never remarked upon it much. I once asked him about it, and he said, well, you know, this place used to be a house, and there's a second story, but I don't use a second story. I just use it as a storeroom or whatever. And so I just never paid any attention to it after that.
All right.
But one day, I happened to be there, and a rather attractive young woman came down the stairs and went out the front door. And I said, man, I didn't know you had someone living here. And he said, and he was a married man, by the way, with a wife and children.
Yeah.
And I said, I didn't know that was, where'd she come from? And he said, oh, she lives upstairs. I said, well, you never told me about that. He said, we never asked. I said, well, she lives upstairs. And he said, yeah, you know, there's a few rooms up there, and she was looking for a place to live, so I rented it out to her. I said, well, what does she do? And he says, I have no idea. And he said, she comes and she goes, she's quiet, she doesn't bother me or anyone else, and so I don't worry about it. You know, she pays me a little bit of rent, and that's it. I said, okay. Now, I never thought any more about that until the census came around in 2000, and I happened to be speaking with him, and I said, look, because the census, my point is not everyone fills it out. I asked him about that. I said, look, you know, you filled out the census form for your house, your wife and your children and you. I said, what about the girl upstairs? Did you tell the census about them? I said, no. And I said, you didn't mention it? And he said, no. I said, did they stop by the store? He said, yes. And I told him, you know, it's just a store here. No one lives here. I said, did you mention the girl living upstairs?
Right.
And he said, no.
Okay.
Now, how many times does that happen across the country?
Good question. Sure, I'm sure many.
Many times.
Right. Men.
The people who are here but aren't here. She could have been a Martian for all I know.
We like
people
to,
who are here but are not here. Are there 1 million people like that? 10 million? 30 million? I don't know. You don't know.
Right.
More importantly, the Census Bureau doesn't know.
We like to have the fiction that we have the facts at our disposal and we know what's going on in our society. And, you know, I'm sure you had this experience. I did. Because we both left academia. Now, you finished your PhD program. I didn't. I wrote 150 pages of a doctoral dissertation, and then I bailed.
Yeah.
But I lived through that culture very, very much. And it took me years, more years than it took you, I think, to unlearn some of the truths that I supposedly thought I had from my university years. I mean, I thought that I understood U.S. history pretty well. I thought that I understood the history of the Cold War reasonably well, certainly better than the vast majority of people around me. And yet it's only when you start lift up that rug and you start looking underneath, or you open that door, is a better analogy, and peek into that secret room, when you start to realize that there's this entire world that goes right by the notice of, let's call it, official academic, official media culture. They just don't.
Yeah, and it starts with people who are here but yet aren't here. Illegal immigrants and the girl upstairs. I mean, how many girls upstairs are there? We don't know.
Right. And
who are they? And where are they going? What do they do? Some of them will be men. Some of them will be married couples. Some of them will be illegal immigrants.
Well,
some of them will be on the run from the law. Some of them may be humans from other planets.
Uh-huh. Other planets, and also I was going to think secret government activities.
Secret government activities.
No.
All kinds of people for all kinds of reasons who are here yet not here. And they're all around us, Rich.
Hey, let me ask
and
you
those are the ones that are on the surface. Now think about the ones that are underground who are even more transparent, but they surely do exist.
your published works, you're actually very low-key about the alien connection to all of this. I mean, it becomes, there are little hints that you toss into to some of your various books that indicate you're open to it. But truthfully, in underground bases and tunnels, as well as underground and water, underwater and underground bases,
Yes.
You don't really get into ET types of connections and issues very much.
No.
And be it having spoken with you personally, I know that you're not only open to it, but maybe you even kind of believe in it. But I really wonder what you actually think. I mean, do you think that there's an ET presence here? And if so, how might that relate to some of the work that you've done in your study?
Well, I do. I think there probably are extraterrestrials on the Earth coming and going from the Earth. I believe there may be many Earth-like terrestrial planets sprinkled around the galaxy with resident human populations. I suspect this is one reason for the huge security clampdown on all things ufological. I think that one of the truths that was discovered early on, or perhaps has been known by those in the know for centuries, maybe even millennia, is that not only are we not alone, there are other planets with humans on them. It may be that the galaxy, or so to speak, the warp and the woof of the galaxy is structured in such a way that on terrestrial planets in a certain temperature range with a given amount of water, in other words, where liquid water can exist and does exist, maybe the whole universe is structured to bring forth human beings.
Do you think we could have been seeded?
Seeded actually into the structure of the, hardwired into the structure of this 3D reality right across the galaxy, that on terrestrial-type planets, maybe you have carbon-based biology arise, and maybe once carbon-based biology arises, maybe it's only a question of time, whether 1 billion years or 10 billion years or 500 million years, until you get primates like us, human beings, and you may have viable human populations on multiple, maybe even many, planets around the galaxy. And in fact, the UFO literature suggests that this is true, because over and over again, contactees have reported seeing humans.
Yeah.
People that look much like us, with two legs, two arms, a head, two eyes, hair, that look human-like.
A lot of people are not aware that there's so many reports of human-looking UFO
activity. Many. And in fact, in some cases, the Antonio Villas case from, Boris Villas case from Brazil is just one, that where this very human-looking and attractive female-looking human actually engaged this farmer in sexual intercourse, and he found her to be a desirable female.
Is this a Brazilian case? Is this the one you're referring to?
In the Brazilian case, yes.
1957, the very well-known case in UFO history, research of a Brazilian farmer in, I think, fall of 1957, who encounters, he was taken aboard a vessel. And this is in a period when no one was talking about alien abductions at all.
No.
And his story was so, so out there that for years, American researchers, I mean, they knew about this, but they just would not touch it with a 10-foot pole. But the problem is this guy was, actually went on to be a professional, I think a lawyer, never really sought to make money off of it. He wrote this 8-page long deposition on it, and people actually ended up interviewing him and were persuaded that he was truthful.
Yeah.
So,
and then there have been many other cases where people have reported encountering humanoids of different kinds, and
right,
more than humanoids, human-appearing occupants of these strange craft, UFO-like craft. Travis Walton case, he reports seeing these people, and there are many, many others. We don't have time to discuss all of them. Those who like can go and read thousands of pages of UFO literature like Rich Dolan and I have done, and you will also encounter these same stories. But they pop up again and again and again. so often that I accept that there are other, essentially, human beings. If they're not exactly like us, they're very close to us. And they are here and or coming here, evidently from elsewhere.
Here's a theory I want to ask you. I want to ask you this question now, because I'm aware of these human-type reports, many of them as you are. And I speculated, what if you have an alien or non-human population that's living here? And of course, they might have lots of reasons to live here. We've got a great planet. We've got wonderful biological diversity. We've got a lot of neat things here. We humans are actually quite interesting, in my opinion. So it wouldn't be shocking to me that non-humans would want to come down here and observe us. My speculation is that they may not just be able to walk around on the planet's surface as easily as we do. There's microbes and bacteria, and there's solar radiation that might not be good. So would they not want to create a nice, secure underground facility that would be amenable to them? I think, sure, why not? But then, what if they have desires to interact every so often with topside, that is, with our civilization? I've often speculated that wouldn't they just want to breed their own human population and maybe enhance those people and put little chips in them and maybe genetically modify them to a certain extent and have them do work for them? In other words,
that's
breed
possible.
An entirely captive human population?
That's possible. I think that scenario is plausible, and indeed it may have happened. And I discussed I was out at the Laughlin conference earlier this year. I think it was the last week of February or such. And I discussed that in my give and take with the audience. I suspect there is more than one human population on this planet. Let me tell you in brief capsule form what I tend to think is going on. There is the topside, more or less, consensual human reality. We all mutually consensual human reality we all are familiar with, that presumably most of the people that are tuning into this broadcast are immersed in. When I, Rich, are immersed in this, we went to public schools, we went to universities or a university, we have a job, we drive a car, we live in a house.
We do work for a living, it's true, people.
Yes. So there's that society which we are all familiar with because we're immersed in it. Then, I do not at all dismiss the possibility of another second human society, such as you discuss, where you may have beings, whether human or non-human, who come here from another planet and maybe have a secret base or more, underground and or undersea, but they desire to interact with those on the topside. So they may kidnap some humans and breed their own human population, but a human population that works for them and who they support. And they may use these humans that are their humans, so to speak, to do their work. Now, these humans would then have very little in common with us. And in fact, might even by choice, even if they were set free, not associate from us. They might find us so bizarre because we're so removed from their experience that even if they were to, so to speak, to escape, they may not prefer our company.
Right. Interesting that
so
you and I both...
So they would be able to interface with us because they look like us,
right. But
yet would not be part of our society.
Yeah.
So they might move among us without attracting undue attention, yet without being part of our society.
Here's a question now. Let's just go a little further afield.
There's two other populations I see of humans that could be here. There could be a third population of human, or more than one population of human, that are coming from other planets with resident human populations in this galaxy. And then there could be yet a fourth population of humans on this planet that would be a subset, if you will, within our modern times, from the 21st and 20th century, that have set up residence underground and the compartmentalized black world, and they may now have a resident multi-generational breeding population underground, and they too might prefer their society to ours, because once you're underground for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years and you lose contact and
you don't want to come up,
it would be a foreign environment. There may be people living underground now, our ages, from stories of the surface world or a legend.
Just amazing. There are so many ways to look at this phenomenon because, I look at it from a UFO type of series of questions, and I'm constantly asking myself, are these UFOs alien? Are they ours? If they're human, they could be a secret black program that is something that's, yes, ultra secret, but still, loosely within the structure of our civilization. But then, as you're suggesting here too, I've wondered, is there an entirely separate human civilization that is living underground, that has had access to revolutionary technology for a long period of time, that is independent of our own civilization?
I think so. And I've just given you four human civilizations or societies that I think could be here on the Earth right now. In fact, I think probably are. Let me give you a fifth one, Rich.
Okay.
And the fifth one would be relict populations that would have been holed up underground in ancient times, antediluvian times, before the flood, the Atlanteans, in other words, for want of a better term. And it's clear to me from the research I've done that there was at least one round of high civilization in remote antiquity and maybe multiple waves of high civilization.
You went to the pyramids earlier this year. You were at the pyramid, weren't you?
Yes. And what I can say is everything I've seen, to me, screams that this is not the first human civilization on this planet with high technology. And I think there have been other rounds of high technology in the distant past, thousands of years ago, and evidence for that can still be seen in some places. The pyramids and other monuments in Egypt are just one example. The platform at the Al-Bek in the Baikal Valley in Lebanon is another example, and there are multiple examples like this all around the planet. And in some cases, these things, these monuments from the distant past, cannot be duplicated still, even with the technology that this civilization has today. They're just too huge, too large, and in some cases, the stones on these things are cut with an optical precision that our quarrying technology today cannot yet match.
It's incredible.
And yet we have these things from thousands of years ago. So clearly there was high technology in remote antiquity on this planet, and it was used, and the knowledge of it has been lost, and the people that made these things have been obliterated, and most traces and records of them have been lost in the sands of time. But they leave these monuments behind, which indicate, yes, in the distant past, I'm talking many thousands of years ago, there was high civilization on this planet, and probably more than once. So I'm thinking, and I saw plenty of evidence of underground excavation in Egypt when I was there. I've been there twice. The Egyptians made a lot underground, and I assume that mainstream archaeology has only revealed a small portion of what they've really found, because the cover-up is on in every other sphere of human activity that I've run across so far, and I'm coming to find out that mainstream archaeology is no different from mainstream politics or military policy or, anything else. There are secrets within secrets, and that's true of archaeology as well. So it's clear that the Egyptians built a lot underground. They dug underground, and you go to Giza and you'll see opening to the underground all over the Giza plateau.
Rich, do you realize we have gone through 2 hours?
Well, do we have a couple more minutes?
Yes, please. We have one more minute.
Well, and what I want to say is I believe it's also possible that there were relict populations underground from Atlantean times and from ancient Egyptian times when the great cataclysms hit that we can still read and hear echoes of in our myths and legends, like the Great Flood, for example. And they did have high technology, and I believe we still could have relict populations from remote antiquity still hold up underground. But they have nothing in common with us. They have an advanced technology, a high civilization, but I think they remain to the they kept to themselves after the catastrophes. And I suspect some of them are still here as well. And by the way, some of this high technology certainly does involve, in my view, the capability to go back and forth through time.
Wow. We'll have to end it on that note because, guess what? We flew through two amazing hours. And anyone who's listening, I have to say that, see, I'm lucky because I get to talk with Richard Sauter many, many times. And so this is just a kind of a taste of what frequently we have when we talk, wouldn't you say?
I would say.
Yeah.
This could be a Rich Dolan, Richard Sauter conversation.
We could do it. And I have a feeling I'd like to do it again if my dear wife will allow me to guest host in the future. She said to me, oh, yeah, I love being a host of a radio show, but look, I'd like it if you wouldn't mind guest hosting every now and then. So, Richard, you were my first guest, for my very first show ever, and I really want to thank you personally for coming out because it was amazing, fabulous. I think you had so much of value to tell people. You don't right now have a website, that's true, but you do have books on Amazon.
Yes, if people want to find my books, which are currently out of print, by the way, they can still go to Amazon.com and maybe even to Barnes & Noble, but I know for sure it's Amazon.com, and you can still find them there.
They're out there, and really well worth the effort to read.
Also through Interlibrary Loan. My books are available through Interlibrary Loan. If you have a library card at a university or college or local lending library, you can obtain them that way.
Dr. Richard Sauter. Rich, thanks very much. And that's it for our show. My name is Richard Dolan. You've been listening to Through the Keyhole on ParanormalRadioNetwork.com. Thanks a lot. Behold on Paranormal Radio.